Amateur Presentation.
Welcome back to another Untitled Movie Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Matt Rohrbeck, alongside, he's allergic to tomatoes, but he is tomato meter approved, Eric Marchin.
Matt, I'm going to let you in on something a little personal. Well, it's more so for the listeners because it's about you. And it's something that you don't like to talk about that often. And I understand that it's a personal thing and you like to keep it in your family. You know, you talk to friends about it, but I think it's fair on this episode and to be transparent about it because it's time, you know, and I don't mean to out you in any way, but I know that you were excited for this movie and you're a big fan, you know, of the film. And so, you know, it was interesting, but I wanted to get your take on what it felt like to finally see a Wild Hogs reunion between William H. Macy and Kevin Durant.
You know, people aren't talking about this enough, Eric. Like, I remember working at Cineplex when Wild Hogs came out. And what a cinematic masterpiece. So I think, like, not enough people online. Like, yes, okay, the Matt Reeves Planet of the Apes movies were amazing. Yes, it's maybe one of the most underrated franchises going right now, that, you know, it might be one of the best cinematic franchises going, but it all started, this movie wouldn't exist without Wild Hogs.
Yes. Right?
So thank you for bringing that up. It's you know, one of the best movies of all time, Wild Hogs.
Did a double bill with that in Zodiac.
Did
I remember
you?
I did
you actually?
I did.
Wild Hogs did really well, didn't it?
It did. Well, they kept threatening a sequel for
a decade.
Because I think it hit that sort of middle age kind of crowd that isn't really served demographically.
Yeah, they're not given enough, you know, that age group.
Those baby boomers.
today we are reviewing Wes Ball's Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Starring people like William H. Macy, Kevin Durant, Owen Teague, Freya Allen, and Peter Macon.
Macon?
Yeah, yep. Macon Bacon. How you doing, Eric, other than Wild Hoggin?
Well, wow. See, we're making it personal. The other thing, I was also thinking of, like, how can I connect? I was going to be like, maybe Wes Ball has directed episodes of Ballers. You know, what's his take on the show Ballers?
I was going to go Kingdom of the Planet of the Hogs, you know.
Kink of the Planet of the Hogs. You know, I'm good. I'm good. I saw that horrible interview on the red carpet for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, you did with Owen.
Yes, that was me mumbling to him in their face.
I mean, you did do a great interview, though.
Yes.
So that kind of balances.
Yeah, so if you want to see the interview that I did with Kevin Durant and Owen Teague, it's on the site. It's on podcasts, you know, platforms everywhere, wherever you get your podcasts. It's there. It was really nice talking to those guys and getting some really interesting insights and tidbits into not only the making of, but I even asked them about the uncut version that Wes Ball is going to release on the physical media version. So, you know, the Blu-rays and the 4Ks. And I thought that answer was kind of interesting as well, because I wasn't expecting them to be that positive. And maybe there's a part of it where it's like, I don't know, because I signed up knowing that this is going to happen. But yeah, it was an interesting conversation with that as well.
Yeah, I think that's a cool idea. And I liked Owen Teague saying, like, oh, his friends and family wanted to, they're like, oh, I actually, like, want to see your face in the suit. Like, obviously, you know, it's him giving a performance much like Andy Serkis did in the last three. But I think it's a cool idea. I don't know if I'll watch the whole thing that way, but I think it'll be fun to kind of pop in. But yeah, this one was one that I was really, really looking forward to. So I kind of already alluded to it, but you know, Planet of the Apes, obviously the franchise has been around since the 60s, you know, recently had a reboot or a prequel, whatever you want to call it, in the previous trilogy. I keep saying the first one was Wyatt Russell, but it's Rupert Wyatt who directed the first one. With Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and then was taken over by Matt Reeves, who I think made two of the best recent blockbusters in like the last 10, 15 years. I think those movies, you know, they've done well. They were got great reviews, but are weirdly underrated. Like, I feel like the Planet of the Apes movies, like, doesn't get talked about like some of the other big franchises that are going, well,
especially
right
the
now.
Superhero movies, yeah. But even in the same sort of vein as like something like Alien, you know, like all of those movies are cherished and rewatched and talked about. And, you know, the first Planet of the Apes movie was a big deal. And the more you learn about that with the co-writer, Michael Wilson, who was blacklisted, and, you know, that gives greater context to the Dr. Zaius trial hearings with Charlton Heston's Taylor. But then afterwards, you get four sequels that are in varying degrees of quality, where two to three, Beneath the Planet of the Apes and Escape from the Planet of the Apes, are basically remakes of the first movie, or trying to do the same thing over again. And then when you get to Conquest and Battle, Conquest is the most interesting, and Conquest is where Rupert Wyatt, not Wyatt Russell, got a lot of the influence with the simian flu and the final sort of battle on the bridge.
Yeah. So we will be, sorry, just,
oh, and Tim, I was going to say quickly, don't erase Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. You can't include that.
Say hi to your mother for me. All right. We're going to be spoiling the previous trilogy, talking about all of this stuff. We will not spoil main plot points from Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, because it's only being released today as we're recording it. Like, tonight will be the first screening. So we'll stay away from major spoilers for Kingdom. But obviously, if you don't want to know anything, we only really talk about stuff that's in the trailers, and then kind of allude to everything after that. But yeah, man, so we get this sequel, which is set generations in the future, starring a new kind of crew of apes the movie led by Noah. He's not necessarily the leader, played by Owen Teague. I don't know where you want to start, Eric, but I'll throw it. You know what? I'm going to kick it off. So
you do it. I know, because the Wild Hogs is burning. Yeah, deep it's inside burning.
My hog is burning. This is exciting, because like, I love those previous three movies to different extents. Like, Rise, I think, is the weakest of the three. Wyatt Russell's Rise is the weakest of the three. But, you know, the humans are the weakest in that movie. But I think that whole bridge sequence and how that movie ends in that last act is really great. And then I think the Matt Reeves movies are almost both masterpieces. Like, I think it's one of the best sequels ever made in Dawn, and then War is fantastic as well. This was exciting because my wife Nevis, I've told her over and over again, I'm like, no, that Planet of the Apes movies fucking rock. And it's just like, someone who doesn't get it and they just see like talking ape movie and they're like, that sounds silly, or I don't want any part of it, essentially. Like, I think people who don't get it, like, and I get that they don't get it, just are like, that doesn't sound good. And then we saw a trailer for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, and there's the sequence where you see the villainous group of apes trying to capture some of the humans, and Nevis turns to me in bed and goes, I wonder what happened for them to get to this place. And I was like, oh, I have the movie trilogy for you.
Babe, so, wake up. I have the movie trilogy for you.
So we went back and I showed her the newer trilogy with Rise, Dawn, and War. And she fell in love with them. She's bawling by the end of it. I think it's such a masterful trilogy of Caesar's story from beginning to end. And how this, you know, very different of like how we got to the point of that first 1968 movie.
Yep.
I think it's just such a masterful trilogy. I think Michael Giacchino's score and all that stuff. So I just watched those three movies, like right leading into Kingdom. So I just kind of wanted to preface that of where my thoughts are coming from. And I think everything from the cinematography, the direction, the music from Michael Giacchino, everything is the performance from Andy Serkis as Caesar is incredible. Koba as a villain, amazing. The human characters are great too. So
Maurice
is incredible. So getting into Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, I think because I just watched those three movies, my expectations were like here. Like, I think those movies are incredible and I was very, very excited for them. Wes Ball, a guy that I like, and the Maze Runner movies, while they're not great, I weirdly kind of enjoyed those three movies. And another trilogy of movies, you almost forget that there was three of them and that they did.
But he directed all three.
Like, yeah, he did. And he completed that trilogy. And they're okay. They're not, but you see why they might have hired him for this with the post-apocalyptic kind of stuff. So anyways, getting to my thoughts of this movie. I really enjoyed it. I think even sitting on it, I've enjoyed it a little bit more even. I think my initial thoughts after the movie were, okay, that was like a fun summer blockbuster, a good popcorn movie, a good continuation of the franchise, but maybe doesn't hold a candle to those previous two Matt Reeves films. It might be better than Rise. I think it's a better, well-rounded movie, but I was left feeling like satisfied, but not like enthusiastic about the movie.
The trailers, I think, really sell something more sort of action-packed almost. Yeah.
Which I'm okay with it not being like super action packed or anything. But I think after I sat on it, I've come to like, I still think it's a movie you should absolutely go see in theaters. I think it's something that it's an intriguing start to this new trilogy or this new era of this franchise. I think the performance from Owen Teague as Noah is great. I think that was a lot to live up to, especially having to follow Andy Serkis in those previous three films. I think how they utilize Caesar and his legacy in the film, because it's hundreds of years later, or I think it's hundreds of years later, but they say it's, many generations.
Wes Ball has like, talked about it being about 300 to 400 years later.
So I really love how they use like Caesar and religion and how he's become basically a Christ-like figure and how that can get twisted and how there's only a few apes left that still remember his story and try to pass on his messaging and his true thoughts and what the world was like before. Like, I love all that. There's an ape. What's that ape's name, Eric? The ape that Raka, right?
Yeah.
I love Raka in this movie and he's the one kind of priest-like figure talking about.
Well, he's an archivist, like, right? Yeah, like, he's a historian.
Historians are great.
Term. Yeah, he keeps sort of, you know, Caesar's legacy in check, because the idea of, you know, the prophecy that Caesar wanted to unite not only apes but find a balance between humans and primates, yeah, is being twisted and
manipulated
corrupted
by Kevin Durant's Proximus Caesar, who I think is a good villain in the movie as well. So I think that's some of the best stuff in the movie, the stuff with Raka and Noah, knowing Noah learning about, you know, the past, and, you know, he's been kind of sheltered in his community that raise eagles and stuff like that, and they're kind of separate from you know, Proximus Caesar and his kingdom and things like that. So I think this, like, and another thing I love about these movies, they all have a completely different vibe. Like, they all feel like they're a different genre almost, right? And I think Rise, Dawn, and War, and now continuing that with Kingdom, like, this feels like an adventure movie a bit more than the other ones, right? And I think, like, adjusting to that took me a second, right? And I always forget, like, oh yeah, each one of these movies has a very specific vibe that is different than the previous one, and it's something that I actually really love about them. So I love the story of Noah and Nova, or we learn as May in the movie, and it is this.
It's gonna be May.
Yeah, and this adventure vibe and how that plays out. I think, you know, there's some lulls at times, and maybe it takes a little longer to get going or ultimately get to where it lands, and I think that's maybe my biggest issue with the movie, is that, you know, those last two Matt Reeves movies, you're fucking locked in from start to finish, and like, they are nonstop, even though they have quiet emotional moments and things like that. But I felt at times I was drifting away as it took longer to get into this story, and then ultimately some of the emotional beats I don't think work as well they're fine and you know, enjoyable. Like, I never once was like, I dislike what I'm watching. Like, it was always enjoyable. I'm like, okay, the action, it looks gorgeous. Like, Weta are magicians. Like, the CG in this movie is crazy. Like much like the last two of like the close-ups on the apes and their facial expressions. And you see that they've learned so much even on those Avatar movies and on Way of Water and stuff like that, of facial capture and just like all this stuff. And I'm also a sucker, you know, this, like, if you align with my tastes out there, I really love post-apocalyptic, you know, dystopian. I love overgrown, you know, buildings with the vegetation that's grown over them over 400 years, and these beautiful vistas that both feel like jungles, and like even how this is becoming a planet of the apes, where you see the old world of bridges and buildings, but it's all taken over by this gigantic jungle just because everything's overgrown. So I think all of that stuff I really love as well. So like I'm sounding very positive, and I am. I just think my initial like right afterwards was a bit like, okay, I liked it, but I didn't like it as much as those Reeves movies. So I'm trying to kind of remove myself from that and just go, okay, as a new Planet of the Apes movie, is this enjoyable and does this work? And I ultimately think it does. Like, I really did enjoy it. I'm intrigued about the ending of the film and where this franchise is going. I think the mystery box throughout the film actually works, of what May or Nova is looking for and what's driving all the characters. Like, I like all of that. So it left me in a spot where I was like, oh hell yeah, I'm in. I want to know what happens next, and whether that's Wes Ball continuing that, or they pass, much like the original, not original, you know, the previous trilogy, passes it on to a new filmmaker as he goes to make The Legend of Zelda. I think that could work as well. But I like the cast. I think William H. Macy, I think you just needed another human in the movie.
Well, like, you need a veteran actor, yeah, right? Like, yeah. It's the thing where you have in the first.
And sorry, I'll let you go in a second.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. You have John Lithgow. In the second, you have Gary Oldman. In the third, yeah, you have Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
And that's one of the few. He's not bad in the movie, but the way that he's introduced in sort of the final act, or the last section of the film, feels a little bit clunky, and it's almost like, hi, I'm William H. Macy, Award nominee.
I totally agree with that. And you just needed another human for, you know, May to talk to or get some information from and stuff like that. So I'll wrap up, but like, I ultimately really enjoyed it. Maybe not as much as the previous two films, but I still think it's absolutely worth your time. And I am very intrigued to where this goes next. So Eric, I'll pass it off to you.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in the same forbidden zone as you, where I think this is a very satisfying sequel. And it actually reminds me a lot of The Force Awakens, where it's trying to include little bits of the past trilogy in this movie, where, you know, you're setting the table again, introducing a new character, whether or not they continue with Noah, that they might not. It almost feels like this could be a singular story in some ways, but you're introducing a new character. You're reintroducing the world so many hundreds of years in the future, which is a smart decision on screenwriter Josh Friedman's decision, because, you know, you have that distance between the original and, you know, the original trilogy and this, and people aren't going to necessarily be like, oh, well, let's bring in, you know, this character. Exactly. So, you know, you can't, because they're all dead. And so that you give the grounds to build something new within the established world that was set up. And that's the thing that I think Rupert Wyatt doesn't get enough credit for. You know, he gave Matt Reeves the runway to take off in a way that, like, if Matt Reeves had directed Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I'm sure it would have been great, but it's still the movie where you have to bring everything together in order to start up. And so this movie feels like that in the beginning, and that, in the same way with Rise. And then with Dawn is getting more into how Andy Serkis's Caesar is becoming a leader, and you see how Noah, through his journey as, you know, son to leader to, you know, almost that kind of status that Caesar had, and learning not only about who Caesar was, but the relationship that humans had to apes before. And you see this conflict, this inner conflict, where, and especially with May, you see an aspect of that relationship always kind of at a distance, even when they're working together, you know, and that's something I actually really appreciated throughout this entire movie, is that May can be a very unlikable character at times, and it's not showing the best side of humanity in certain moments. And I think that's also important, that, you know, it's playing with, you know, if the first three movies before this one were about freedom, this is about dominance and control and maintaining those things, and who has the power and who has the control in this world that is, you know, in existence now. And so that relationship is important. And so you see that conflict, that inner conflict of Noah basically thinking, okay, well, Raka is teaching compassion and, you know, openness and trying to do the right thing, where he's the angel on the shoulder. And then once you get to Proximus. I keep doing this. Proximus Caesar. Once you get to Proximus Caesar, there's this interesting kind of balance that he's not just simply a villain, but he's almost seducing Noah in a way and saying, come on to my side. The emperor. It's like, you know, join me. Like, this is what we can take from the humans and apply it to our own species now and be in total power and control. And that's what I find also just
even
riveting.
Calling back to Koba a little bit, right?
Like, yeah. Well, even cool. even just like this, the most simplistic thing of the kingdom being set on the beach, which is where the first movie, the 68 film,
it looks
ends.
Exactly like that beach.
Exactly. And so, and so like these things are all there, and even calling, you know, the Forbidden Zone and things like that. Like, it's very smartly written, and, you know, the final sequence kind of being the battle or the war. And it does feel like you're getting this greatest hits of the last three movies. But then, as you mentioned, the opening of what's possible to come next and what could be is, I think, going to excite people the most, that maybe feel like, okay, it is self-indulgent to a certain degree as we're wandering through all of this foliage. And it's, you know, the actual apes are incredible, and you never feel an, you know, uncanny valley with them. But there is an aspect of it where, like, you are questioning, okay, what sets are real and which ones are fake?
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of that. And you know, the Last of Us comes up a lot now, but you can tell, like, even with the Maze Runner movies, I remember you telling me, like, with the Scorch Trials in particular, that Wes Ball, you know, that influence is there, and you can see it even now. Like, Ball has this thing with dystopian set stories, and, like, there's certain buildings in the way that they're collapsed on each other that look like they're from the Maze Runner movies as well. The shipwrecked kingdom, I think, is a beautiful looking sort of design. And even in that last act where they go with a certain location, it feels almost like a video game in terms of how you problem solve and how characters work together in order to get something. And even that, you know, the biblical sort of allegory of, you know, Caesar being Moses leading his people to the promised land and freedom, and now being the Messiah, that his legacy and his words are being used to self-serve someone else who believes that they're the second coming of Christ, you know, and that, like, I think Kevin Durant is one of those guys. I like him. He's a good sort of, like, imposing actor. He's also in Abigail recently, Cosmopolis. He's actually quite good in as well. But there is something where, like, he can go too big. And, like, I think of something like Adam Egoyan's The Captive, but here he has the perfect amount of, like, mustache twirling villain, but then also there's something about him, and he even said it in the interview, that he admires sort of the Roman history and the dominance of the human species and wants to apply that to his own and wants to have the knowledge. And the knowledge thing, I think, is more interesting than simply, you know, having a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah, because the Macy character goes and like reads to him, right?
Because knowledge is power. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. And so like those little details really help make this movie a bit of a baller in terms of its filmmaking and its style. And, you know, there are certain things. I think there's a natural conclusion to the relationship between May and Noah. And it feels like there's a little bit of a tag on in the final sort of interaction that they have. And it's not necessary. And it almost comes off as a little goofy. But yeah, I think Owen Teague's one of those guys. Like, if you haven't seen Montana Story, he was really wonderful last year in You Hurt My Feelings, playing Julie Louis-Dreyfus's son. Like, he's one of those guys that's like, he's on the rise. And every time he's in something, whether it's like a really small role, he's in the It movies as one of the bullies. He's always good. He's always really good. So I'm happy that he's... He plays one of the prison guards, the orderlies. So he's always great. And yeah, and I like that the cast isn't necessarily, other than William H. Macy, are like name actors.
Yeah.
You know, they're not Noah, Nona. Yeah. But because it makes it less distracting. You know, you had the original films, and Charlton Heston was a big star at that point, and Roddy McDowall was a name and things like that, but these movies feel like they're really focusing on the IP before the star power. And that's where it goes. And then you have, you know, the technological advances that are always climbing new heights. And, you know, this, in my opinion, and this is, I guess, would be the hot take I have for this whole thing. This world and these creations are so much more interesting and engaging than anything in the Avatar films.
I think I'm right there with you with the spicy take there. I wish this got the attention that the Avatar movies do.
Yes.
Because I think it also has similar metaphor, not similar, but like it
well, environmental than, and animal yeah, cruelty.
Exactly. And, yeah. And I'm 1,000% with you. And I think it uses the tech in a very similar way, but the way that, you know, if for you to buy into the, you know, apes, like, talking to each other and stuff, and you go back to that first moment in Rise where Caesar first says no, and I think just the progression of is just masterful in all of these movies, from both the individual characters and just the apes as a whole and stuff like that. And I agree with you with the, like, you know, even in the last one you had actors like Steve Zahn and Toby Kebbell and Judy Greer as apes and stuff, but they were never really, like, I think they were such great performances that you never once were like, Steve Zahn maybe to an extent as Bad Ape, but Judy Greer, I don't think you would have ever, like, they do such a good job that I think it's not really, the focus isn't on them other than Andy Serkis. And you obviously, the human actors is where you get some more known actors, but even the even Freya Allen, who I'm not like super familiar with, she hasn't been in that much, right? But
yeah,
even having her as the basically lead human in the film, I think, is interesting too. So I think the action set pieces are exciting. It looks gorgeous. The score is the one thing that I think maybe I will just be, say it's like a bit of a downgrade. I don't know. Maybe I'd have to listen to it again or pay more attention to it. I think Giacchino, we've talked about him many times, like when he wants to pop off, he can pop the fuck off. And like,
he does so, like, it, that's his scores, especially in Dawn and War, do so much of the heavy lifting.
Oh, totally. And that's not to discredit anything else in the movie, because I think the cinematography and the acting is all great, but his score is so fucking good. When he adds, like, when he wants to deliver, he delivers. And when he wants to phone it in, he phones it in.
Yeah.
So with John Paisano, like, I don't know. I just never once was like, after the movie, I kept going, da da da, dun, dun, and I was like, oh, that's the Giacchino score. I keep going back to that. And like, even in my head after this movie, I've been like humming a lot of the Giacchino score. And there's a little bit of it in this movie because they, at the very beginning, but they don't bring back any of Caesar's themes or any of the themes, at least from, I might be wrong, but from my first, there's a few moments where, you know, they do bring back themes like the apes theme and stuff like that. But I didn't, not that I wanted you to just rehash the same music, but I like recurring themes. I just long-winded. I just didn't find the score particularly memorable. And what about you?
Yeah. And also they do, there's a bridge scene in this movie that they bring back the original 68 theme.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And it's there. And as soon as you like hear the sort of the first couple of notes, you're like, okay, this is where they're putting it. I agree. I think Giacchino's score is integral to the Matt Reeves films. And I think Matt Reeves brings the best out of him because they talk about collaborating even in the script process of, you know, like with the Batman, like he was thinking about it while they were writing that score. And so like coming together, it feels like it adds a texture and a layer to the storytelling. And it's not just simply, you know, audio for the sake of like, you know, having a great soundtrack. Like it feels integral to the narrative, where with this, it's very, you know, I don't want to just simply call it like, it's like a dollar store kind of like thing, but it does feel like maybe out of everything in this movie, probably the least memorable, or it doesn't really have its own distinct voice. It's just very generic on kind of a, you know, almost like a temp basis at times. And that's fine. But yeah, there is something about when like a score really connects with the narrative and
it elevates, you know, the material, right?
Well, yeah. Especially even with, you know, last year with Across the Spider-Verse, like that score really helps move the story along. Or even when we were talking about Challengers, there's something about how when you're working within the narrative, if you can put it in there, it's like, it's not just simply sitting there and you're hearing it. It's like, oh, it's telling you something about
it. All works
character.
Harmoniously, right? With the
it's
images
a balance
on screen, where music can often just be set dressing just there to kind of like, so it's not silent throughout the whole film, which can work too. But like, there was nothing particularly stand out about it working with what was happening on screen. It was serviceable, I'd say the score is.
Yeah.
And Giacchino hasn't really popped off in a while. Like, I'm going back. We have this.
Well, the Batman theme.
Yes. And I forget about the Batman because he does so much now where, you know, he did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things since the Batman, and the Batman was only 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So the Batman is great. Don't get me wrong. So yeah, I guess that was only 2 years ago, but he's done so much since that I might.
But that happens with composers too, right? Where it's like you distinguish a style, and then, you know, that style puts you in demand and everybody wants you to do the same thing or a variation on it. And then it gets watered down, or you're spread so thin that you have people within, you know, your group doing the work for you. Like,
and
I know Hans Zimmer hands off movie scores to people in his company,
which is totally fair. But
it loses its personality at that point. Like the thing that you come to love about a certain composer. Like, I always worried about that, like, after The Social Network, because it was such an iconic score. I haven't gotten sick of Reznor and Ross yet, and especially after Challengers. But there is a thing where, and this has nothing to do with the score, but the thing I am sick of, and this is more so on a marketing side of thing, is having a slow cover of a song in a trailer or ad. Like, I'm over it. Let's, you know, let's put a moratorium on it.
What about a drug scene in a movie where everyone gets...
No, thanks. I don't think I was ever a fan of that, really, to be honest. But that's tough to sell. Even drunk acting is really tough.
None of that in this movie. So.
No.
I wanted to also touch on, you brought up it feeling like a video game at times. And I didn't think of it in the same way in the last act, where the location is and stuff like that, or what they have to do to unlock that location. But there are like little side quests and stuff like that, which obviously I think is relevant because Wes Ball doing the Legend of Zelda movie. coming up, which means he probably won't do another Apes movie. I gotta feel like Zelda is going to be a massive, massive thing. And I,
well, especially if it's live action too.
Yeah. Right? So I really don't think that he, even though, like, I know he did all three Maze Runner movies, and maybe he could do Zelda and then come back to Apes. You don't necessarily need to rush a sequel or anything, but.
And it depends how this does and how quickly they want to fast track it, because this did take 5 years for him to develop.
And that was a pandemic in there and stuff like that. So I get that. But I also just noticed it in the, like, adventure element of the movie even before that. Like, it felt structured, sort of video gamey to me, like, in the sense of even some of the stealth stuff or meeting a side character and having to do a little side quest and stuff like that, or having to get to that final location. And there were other times where I'm just like, oh, this does feel video gamey to me. So he does make sense for Legend of Zelda, especially. I've talked to you off air about, like, depending on which Zelda story they adapt or if they're just going to do an original story. But even the more recent Zelda games have been a similar post-apocalyptic sort of, not necessarily exactly that, but...
Well, this is a simian post-apocalyptic.
Sure, yeah, where... Yeah, okay. But I still think the vibe of the two most recent Zelda games of Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom... fit the vibe of West Ball, so I wouldn't be surprised if that's kind of what they're adapting.
Was the N64 one Majora's Mask?
There's two of them. Majora's Mask was the sequel to Ocarina of Time.
Okay, so it has like a mask, like a heart-shaped mask.
Yep.
On the cover, because I saw mask, somebody at a Union Station with a jacket,
a backpack or a jacket. That game rules. It's very weird. It's the weirdest Zelda game, where it's like, it's not like the other ones at all. The moon has a giant evil face, and it's gonna,
there's spiders in it that are hanging,
crashing into Earth and it time resets. Anyways, I'm excited to see what he does with Zelda. Like, he's one of those guys now that I think he has elevated his, you know, I think this Apes movie is much better than the Maze Runner movies, but
he's a baller now.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what he does with that, and this gives me more confidence in him, because when he was announced for both this and Zelda, I didn't know how I felt, because I'm like, okay, I like the Maze Runner movies kind of more than most, but I wasn't sure if he had that stuff. And I think this movie, okay, maybe he's not in Matt Reeves territory, but like, it still gave me confidence for that Zelda movie. And I think he did a pretty good job.
He has passion for this. You can tell that he cares about what he's doing in terms of being a director and, you know, paying tribute to what's come before, but then also eventually finding his own footing in this world. And, you know, it's unfortunate, because, like, I wasn't the biggest fan of the Maze Runner movies, but, you know, like, there's things in it that it's like, oh, like, I like some of the character actors he's pulling in, and I can see talent there. And then when you hear about a project like Mouse Guard, which fell apart, like, that sounded really interesting. And so you're kind of like, okay, well, even if the Maze Runner movies aren't your cup of tea, but at least when you hear about something like that, that sounds very, you know, different from what he's done before, it gives you a sense, okay, well, there's this, you know, burgeoning, like, I almost feel like he potentially could be a Gore Verbinski down the line. I don't know I don't think he'll be as a sicko, but
did you see that I watched Pirates the other night?
Yeah. And you really liked rewatching it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see the... I guess he could... I get what you're saying. Yeah, he's not as big of a weirdo, maybe, but like... And I mean,
Gore's in his own category.
Weirdo non-derogatory. Like, I mean that in the most positive ways, because...
He's a sicko of cinema.
Man, the first Pirates movie holds up is just like a fun, swashbuckling, like, adventure movie. Like,
the set pieces.
It looks great, man. Like, it looks so good. Like, I put it in the same category as, now we're getting off track, I'm going to give Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes a 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it. What about you?
I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5. Yeah. It's almost there. And I think maybe a rewatch when we get the new trilogy of whatever this is. And when Wyatt Russell comes in to direct 2 and 3, you know, we'll look at it. But this series, like, ultimately is truly underrated, and you just, like, appreciate these movies even more when you see, like, it's like, man, what Reeves and Rupert Wyatt did, I think, does not get enough credit. And
I agree, man. And it's someone joked about it being like, those, the Apes fandom, they'll just quietly go out and see the new movie. It'll do pretty
and
well.
And that's what I love too. Like, they're not like, they're fucking like, Star Wars fanatics that are so toxic. It's like, I also love, you know, you're talking about, you know, Nevis watching them for the first time, but I also love that your dad, who's
my dad,
not
loves them, dude. My mom,
a sci-fi guy, it loves these movies.
Because I think it's nostalgia too, right? Like, he grew up with the original movies, and he, my mom texted me last night and was like, I'll get to Planet of the Caribbean, Pirates of the Caribbean in a sec, to go off topic, but to stay on topic, my mom texted me last night and she's like, should we watch the Planet of the Apes movies in chronological order? And I was like, the hell are you talking about? But I guess she meant like, watch the prequel trilogy in quotes first and then go back. And I was like, yes, do that. I was like, just watch, because I don't know if my mom must have watched the new ones, but my dad loves that trilogy and he loves the old ones too. So like, he came to the War for the Planet of the Apes press screening with me. He came from Oshawa to Toronto to go see it. It didn't,
I gotta see my boy Caesar.
It didn't work out this time to see Kingdom, but so my mom and him, I'm like, yeah, rewatch Rise, Dawn, War, then go see Kingdom, and then if you want, continue with the older ones.
You can skip the Tim Burton movie.
Everyone should skip the Tim Burton movie. It's awful. Actually, if you want a funny review, shout out to friends of the show over at Kind of Funny. They went back and watched the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes movies for in review, because they've been doing the planet, at least the newer trilogy they did, and then they added the Tim Burton one for shits. And it was funny listening to them being like, this might be the worst movie we've reviewed on the show. Like, no, they're like, it's just a miserable time.
It's just, anyways, boring.
Yeah. I'm excited for my dad to see this. I want to get his thoughts on it. And I don't know if my mom had watched them, so I'm excited to see her thoughts too. So back to Pirates of the Caribbean and Gore Verbinski. The first Pirates, one of Nevis's favorite movies. She was obsessed with it when it came out. She said she saw it like 7 times in theaters. She was obsessed with Orlando Bloom.
She loves blacksmiths.
We've become, as adults, like full derogatory, like Disney adults going to like the theme parks a lot and stuff like that. So I was like, you know what? I haven't seen these movies since I was a teenager, and I'd only seen them once. I think we reviewed some of the more recent ones back on like, movie night or whatever, right? And like on Stranger Tides or Dead Man Tells No Tales or whatever. I remember one of them, we went to a press screening. Like, it was maybe one of the earlier press screenings that I'd gone to and stuff like that. But I kind of remember, but I don't remember anything from them, like, other than the Disney ride, which I've gone on many, many times, which it's based off of. And then so we watched it and it kicks ass, dude. Gore Verbinski rules. The set pieces, the sets,
shot on film,
the special effects are up there with Jurassic Park, of like, I can't believe they still hold up as well as they do. Like, yeah, the skeleton dudes from the first movie, like, sometimes
bad man Johnny Depp,
that's another thing, whatever, but like, I just ignore,
but it's the
that.
Character just, you're looking the character. At the yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it just, it's fun, it's funny. The set pieces are amazing. Like, it does the right amount of nods to the ride, to the point where it's not like too much, where it's like, oh, if you're a big fan of the ride, you know the sequence with the dog and the jail cell, or the dude running after the woman, or like the little things from the rides and stuff like that is really fun if you're a big fan. And then it has the Disney stuff in it that is probably maybe my least favorite, which is like the two idiot henchmen adding in some, you know, undercutting some of that, like, because Verbinski can get dark and weird, right? And if the movie if the movie didn't have, so I kind of am on two sides of it, of like, it'll cut to a joke between the two idiot henchmen, which is a Disney trope, right? And just a trope in movies, but like, that is kind of like a silly slapsticky joke or something like that, where I'm like, man, this movie would maybe be better if you just cut all that stuff out. But then I'm like, but then it would be like horrifying for children if you didn't undercut it with some jokes.
You need like the peanut gallery in there to just,
because kinda, like, it gets pretty violent at times and like dark at times. And I love that Verbinski does that and goes there, but like it almost seems like he gets studio notes that is like, this is going to be horrifying for children. We need you to put in some sort of joke in between pirates stabbing people or
he takes the paper throats. And then he just crumples it up and be like,
yeah. But so anyways, it holds up and we're going to go watch those movies now. And then I had a pitch to, we're going way off track. Anyways, this, you basically, we ended
I mean, it's all Disney. So Disney will appreciate that we're talking about pirates.
And I love going to the theme parks and I love it. My pitch to Disney, if anyone at Disney listens to this, which probably don't. And if you do, we really do appreciate you listening to us. My pitch, I was sitting there with Nevis last night and, you know, they've been trying to do the Disney parks, movies, right? Jungle Cruise, Haunted Mansion, you know, Mission to Mars, other things like that. And it's never quite worked, like Pirates being the biggest success for those, right? But they've tried Haunted Mansion, they've tried Jungle Cruise to varying degrees of success. I've enjoyed most of those movies for what they were. And it does make sense to me that, you know, the Imagineers, who are the people who create the rides at Disney and Disneyland, Disney World and Disneyland and the other parks around the world, of course, they're good storytellers, right? Like the rides need to have good stories for people to enjoy the rides. So for some of them to work in film, that makes sense to me. My pitch right now, because of like the ebbs and flows in Disney animation and stuff like that, like, and the success, so I'm bringing it to an area you might appreciate, Eric, the success of X-Men 97. My brain goes to, as a Disney kid from the 90s and that kind of renaissance, like that era of Lion King, Little Mermaid, Aladdin, all of those movies, I go, man, I would love if you took, and they've been trying to think of how they reboot Pirates and stuff like that. Like, I would just love if they took those Disney rides and adapted them into 90s style Disney Broadway, you know, that era of Disney, and do one of those movies again and just see if it works. Like, everyone's loving X-Men 97. Like, take Pirates of the Caribbean or take Jungle Cruise or take Mission to Mars or take whatever you want, a Disney ride, and adapt it like you did with Lion King and, you know, Hunchback of Notre Dame and
like the classic 2D animation.
And because you think that era, we're like, okay, we're doing Broadway style musical movies about stories that already exist, right? Most of them were adapted from some other story, whether even Lion King is Hamlet, and, you know, and they're all fairy tales or they're all adapted from something else. So you already knew that they were great stories. So if you already know your rides are great stories in your head, like maybe some of them more than others, like it could be really fun to adapt those into that style, because people have wanted a 2D animated movie from them for a long time and they thought about it with Wish. They didn't end up doing it, right?
And, well, the Princess and the Frog's like the last one,
and that was 2009, wasn't it? Yeah. Like, and that movie is wonderful. Princess and the Frog is wonderful. And I think with X-Men, if you get a studio that understands that you can do that blended 2D 3D thing, maybe I'm leaning too much on nostalgia, but I think we're at a point in film, like, if you're gonna, I don't know, like, I think people, there's a blend of nostalgia and modern where it's not just purely a nostalgia play, that I think it could be really fun if you did that style of movie, make it a musical like Disney's so good at. I mean, Frozen worked really, really well, which is, and Rapunzel and stuff like that, which are adapting old fairy tales in that Disney musical style, except you have the more 3D CG look to things. But I don't know, I guess X-Men has me very nostalgic for that 2D animation from the 90s and stuff like that, and I feel like you could bring that back in a fun way, like Pirates of the Caribbean or something like that, a remake, but you're adding in more music and doing it in that style that feels like Aladdin or Lion King or any of those movies, Hercules, even at the tail end of that area. But
well, you know what the biggest problem is in this day and age, and it's not money, at least it's not for Disney. I mean, money does play a role in everything. It's time. We live in a world now where, we live in a world where everything has to be delivered quickly, or everybody's anticipating, a studio film or an independent movie to be made within a year is after it's been announced. And so you need to take the time in order to develop these things. And, you know, 2D animation, like traditional 2D animation, the stuff that you're talking about from, you know, like the late 80s with The Little Mermaid into the 90s with Aladdin and The Lion King and things like that, you have to give the time needed in order to fulfill, you know, the quality. And, you know, if VFX departments are any indication, nobody's willing to put in that time anymore. And so you're just left with, you know, people rushing. And so to do a traditional 2D animated movie, I almost feel like they shouldn't even announce that they're doing it, and they should just do it. And then when it's ready, it's ready.
That's the best. That's a great point. And I mean, if you could pump them out every couple of years in the 90s, and I know it's much different now, like workflows, the artists are much different, right? Like you don't have many people that maybe do 2D hand-drawn animation anymore because it's a dying form of animation. Like,
and people give themselves deadlines, and it's impossible to meet those deadlines.
Talking about shareholders and having to push every quarter a new movie or something, right? But I would just like it as like a, I think Disney, and they will do it. I am 1,000% confident, not necessarily this exact idea that I'm pitching, unless they let me come and pitch it to them.
Which yeah, it'll be Home on the Range too.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it. Yeah, that's what everyone's asking for, right? I do think they will make a 2D animated film, even if it's a hybrid one. Like, I feel like if you look at something like Dragon Ball FighterZ, which is a weird pull, everyone, but it's a video game, a fighting game that does, you know, the two, it looks like you're, or South Park Stick of Truth or something like that, where it's like 2D animated, but it's a video game. So it's, they found a way to kind of do it in a computer generated way, but make it look like 2D. And I feel like they just need, and Spider-Verse obviously, and the innovations that that movie has
Invincible.
Invincible, yeah. X-Men 97. I think Disney making X-Men 97, and this is so off topic for Planet of the Apes. So thank
you, man. It's all Disney related. So the people that we have to send this to will not mind.
Yeah, yeah. I really would love something like that again. But I love Planet of the Apes too, so I want more of that to bring it.
Well, even Laika, right, with stop motion. They're cutting corners in order to get a production made quicker, because they'll use 3D printers for facial expressions now, right?
And so they'll have to find a way to imitate that, right? It's all about imitating it. It doesn't necessarily have to be the way it was made before. Look at Planet of the Apes. They found a way to innovate and find a new way to do it and look realistic to bring everything back, right? So, and it's blending. And I think the Apes movies do that so well, of blending the nostalgia of that franchise you know and either love or haven't watched or whatever, but like they do such a good job of adapting it for a modern time. And I feel like there's a way you could do that. Anyways, we'll wrap after that. Disney, if you want to steal my pitch, or maybe you're already doing that, I know you're working on a new Pirates movie with, is Margot Robbie still involved, or are they doing something?
I thought it was Ayo Edebiri.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because Margot Robbie, they were for a while, but then that fell apart, right?
Now she's working with Rob Liefeld for.
That thing. Yeah. Either way, the Disney park, like, I know we're getting more of those. I think we had this whole conversation once of like all the different rides and stuff like that. But we're going to start with Pirates and finish that. And I'm excited. One, I like Gore Verbinski. Let us know what the hell he's up to.
He's got a new movie. They announced that he's shooting in South Africa right now.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Great. I didn't
with Sam
that.
Rockwell.
Oh, fuck.
Hold
yeah,
on,
dude.
As you're reading, I'll bring it up quickly.
We'll finish that because release Gore Verbinski from director jail.
We got to get some good gore on this.
Also,
episode.
Also, if Disney's still looking, I know this was before you guys bought them. A Cure for Wellness kind of rocks. All right. People did not.
Now that would be a good ride.
Oh, man. Yeah, tell me about this because...
Oh, okay, here it is. Here it is. So this is on Collider. 8 years after his latest feature, Gore Verbinski is coming back to the director's chair, his new movie. That's a director who's been in director's jail. I don't get where people are saying Damien Chazelle was in director's...
like 3 years ago.
Yeah, and he's literally making another one right away. So the movie's called Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die, with Sam Rockwell, Haley Lou Richardson, Michael Pena, Zazie Beetz, Juno Temple, and it's being reported as a time travel adventure that is being shot in South Africa.
And is he doing it independently or does he have a studio?
It's independent.
Okay.
So it's going to be off the leash.
Yeah. So that's great. I love that guy. And I think.
Oh, and this is even better. The script is from Matthew Robinson, who wrote Love and Monsters.
Another underrated movie. And brings back to the Maze Runner because it has what's his name in it, right? Who was in the Maze Runner? What isn't it? Or am I mixing those people up?
No, you're not. And I don't know why I can see
his name.
Dylan O'Brien.
Dylan O'Brien. We nailed it, man. But Verbinski.
Ooh, the diss though for A Cure for Wellness on this article. Made for $40 million, gross 26. That's more than you would think, though.
I mean, it's actually way less than you'd probably think because it was released by a major studio.
Yeah. And so you probably put in the marketing campaign of like at least $100 million.
I love that movie. I got to go back and rewatch it. And it's on probably Disney Plus, right? Here in Canada, at least. I'm very excited for that. Oh, yeah. Here's the premise of Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. A man from the future travels to the past and recruits the patrons of a Los Angeles diner he arrives in to help combat a rogue artificial intelligence. I'm fucking in. That sounds great.
Yeah. I mean, if it's gore, you know it's going to get weird.
And have fun set pieces, man. Like, I feel like we even were like, you know, again, you don't love the people involved, but Lone Ranger... I liked it more than most. And like people, Rango is great. Like, you know, come on, Nick Cage and the Weatherman.
Mouse Hunt has some great stuff. Like, yeah.
It's, he's a guy good. Like talking about if someone.
That's who should direct
in,
the next Planet of the
Apes. That's
Ape
what
movie.
I'm saying, dude. All right, we're wrapping it. We got there. Did we plan that? No, but if Gore Verbinski wants
or
to.
Or Wild Hogs, too. Gore Verbinski's Wild Hogs, too.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening or watching. We really do appreciate it. Let us know what you thought of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. And if you're watching on YouTube and you've gotten this far, throw this video a like. We don't plug ourselves enough. I've always learned from the school of YouTube, tell people to do things or ask them to do them, and then they might actually do it. So maybe we should start. Because our YouTube, you know, it's there.
We got a review recently, which was really nice. It was a 5-star review. So
for
thank
YouTube
you.
Or for podcast?
From the podcast.
Oh,
like,
cool.
From iTunes, cool. I think.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Yeah, if you want to drop us a review, it really does kind of help. We don't really ask for much. We just kind of do our thing. But we really appreciate anyone who... listens or watches. Head over to our Letterboxd, which is Untitled_Movies, where we put all of our reviews and our podcasts and YouTube links and all that kind of stuff, other guest appearances we do and stuff like that. So go check that out. And then you can follow me on all those social medias at Matt Rohrbeck.
And I'm Eric Marchand. You can find more of my video reviews on RogersTV.com/CinemaScene. And just quickly, a special shout out to someone who listens to the show, Justin, who I briefly met on the GO train ride going home after watching I Saw the TV Glow. It's nice to know that we have 6 viewers or listeners. And he was very nice. And that was very nice of him to say hello, and he said to make sure to say hi to you.
Yeah,
so
Justin's
appreciate
great.
That
the Doss brothers, they're great dudes.
Yeah.
Shout out to Justin and Jason and everyone else who listens, but yeah, anyone who stops and recognizes Eric Marchand in public can get a
I feel so bad for you.
Can get a shout out on the show. Until next time,
Wild Hogs 2, The Rise of the Hog.
I was gonna say Hogs Together Strong.
That's better.
Bye, everybody.